Today's program is brought to you by Rolling Press, a family-run, eco-friendly printing company. For more information, visit rollingpress.com.
I'm Erin Fairbanks, host of The Farm Report. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hi, and welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palacio. And did you ever wonder if there were a place you could go and live and perhaps live forever? It was so beautiful and the food was delicious and life was easy. A step back in time. I think I found the place for you. The place is called Ikaria, and it's a little rugged island, not so little, off the coast, actually smack dab in the middle of the Aegean Sea, a stone's throw from Turkey and just off the coast of Greece, and it is a Greek island. And there have been articles written about it, and now there's a cookbook written about it, because it's a place where people, they say, forget to die. Is it their diet? Is it the water? Is it the air? I think it's probably a little bit of everything, and we're going to hear specifically on what it's about from my guest today, Diane Kouchilis. Diane is a chef and a host of Greek's most popular TV cooking show. She's a cookbook author of 20 books, okay. And she is indeed an expert on Greek cuisine. Diane, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And you just flew in. You're just bouncing all around the world here.
I literally just flew in.
Well, I'm so glad that we were your first stop. Through this, all of your books, you've always managed to communicate a sense of place with the food. I always get hungry just looking at the recipes and the covers of your books. And this one in particular, you really capture the people and their life. And tell me a little bit about this place. You actually have quite a connection to this place.
I do. It's my it's the place where my father was born and my maternal grandfather. And I've been going there since I was a kid. When I first went there in 1972, it was really off the beaten track. It was a 17-hour ferry ride. There were barely any roads. Electricity had just come to the island. It was really far away. I go back every summer. I've been going there since 1972 in the summers. We run a cooking school on the island. Out of our home, and it's just a magical place. I mean, it's some place where, as a good friend of mine, actually high-powered New York lawyer who came to visit us a couple of years ago, said, I stepped off the boat and the honey of indolence has just kept me in this garden not wanting to do anything. And he was very content. And that kind of sums it up. I mean, it's a very laid-back place.
And something intoxicating about the whole, as he said, the honey of indolence. I mean, something intoxicating about the whole ambiance of being there. Right?
There's something that draws me there for sure, and certainly draws other people to the island. Even after a first experience on Ikaria, where nothing really runs by the clock. I think that's part of the magic. It's very hard for an American maybe to even conceive of that, but it really is what creates this sense of almost serendipity in every interaction. There's always room for something, maybe something else to happen.
actually answered my question and corrected me. It's Ikaria.
It's Ikaria.
Ikaria, okay. You say often in the book that it's people don't wear watches, they pay no attention to time, that they sort of, they know when it's time to nap, when it's time to eat, and they do nap a lot, right?
They do nap, yeah.
And we're talking about people, well, at least, let's step back a little bit. When I looked into the island a little more and was reading about it, I realized this is not exactly that hospitable a place when you first look, especially if you looked at it 100 years ago. I mean, craggy stone and rocky, the soil's not that rich. It reminded me of someplace else that I've spent a lot of time, which is Sardinia. And then I started to read, and you talk about Ikaria being one of in the blue zone.
Right, like Sardinia.
What is, so tell us what the blue zone is.
Well, the blue zones are, it's a term that was coined by, it was actually trademarked by Dan Buettner, but coined by a demographer who literally studied longevity patterns around the world and circled areas around the planet in a blue pencil.
So those were the blue zones.
Yeah, those were the blue zones.
He happened to be holding a blue pencil.
Yeah, completely arbitrary.
Yeah.
And to date, there are, I think, five. It's Ikaria, Sardinia, Okinawa, Costa Rica, and Yorba Linda in California.
Oh, the Seventh-day Adventist
yes.
community, right, yeah.
And I think soon to be, Calabria might be another upcoming blue zone. And these are places where the longevity rates are almost a statistical anomaly. They're inordinately high.
I think and when we say how we're talking 90, we're talking 90, 95, and
right,
more.
And more, right, and more. I mean, I in Ikaria, I think there's the one difference is that people who are that age now, and I've talked to people who are over 100, you know, went to the last few birthday parties of a woman who last year turned 103 or 104. And I think the one thing that sets apart Ikarians who are that old is that they're very much alive and active and part of a community, and many still get around or live on their own. This woman who's 104 is a weaver, still weaves. She's at her loom every day. So I think that there's a sense of being active and at that age that is really unique.
Interesting. I wonder too, you talk about the fact that in doing, or someone who wrote a couple articles, there was an article in the Times, New York Times, a couple of years ago about it too, that they nap regularly.
Nap regularly.
Well, they probably get up with the sun, right?
It depends. I'm from the northwestern part of the island, and that's the part of the island that's very famous all over Greece as the place where, you know, people sort of live at night, and in the daytime it's quite quiet. It's a really odd place.
Because it's hot. It's hot.
Yeah, it's not hot in the winter. It's just, Ikaria is near a group of islands that were a pirate stronghold in the Aegean, so they always had to be very aware of that threat. So life on the island evolved inland, and especially camouflaged in places that were camouflaged from the, not visible from
the coast.
Sea. And that it just spawned a way of life where people had to move around at night, and that kind of remained.
Interesting.
It's an interesting place.
Again, reminding me a lot of Sardinia. And also, and by the same token, it was a place, and you mentioned in your book even, that from the Byzantine era through like the 60s, the undesirables were exiled there, the
right.
banditos or whomever.
No, not the banditos, the political undesirables.
Political undesirables, yeah. And we have a lot, I mean, I'm sure a lot of other undesirables too, but, you know, who could hide there. They knew they could hide there in some of those craggy.
I'm sorry?
You know, a lot of people probably realized they could hide there too, right? Or not.
Well, I think it was more a place of political exile, and that, again, because Ikaria has always been very isolated, those people influenced, I think, the local mindset. Ikaria is a very, in some ways, a very progressive place as a result. It's people have always been, had to make do on their own. There's always been a strong sense of solidarity. There was a barter system that actually still exists in many ways. It was a place that was, for 1 year, in fact, between 1912 and 1913, it was an independent state. There are even stamps that, you know, say it was the state of Ikaria, or the country of Ikaria. But people, I think people just developed this sense of fierce independence and embraced a lot of the, the mindset of the political unwanted.
So they didn't need big government because they were used to surviving on their own. Yeah. Let's talk about the food. You and everyone else who writes about the island agrees that there, aside from the air and the water, there must be something about their diet that is very telling in what's causing them to live so long. So describe to me, you know, like in general first, and then we're going to get into it, a little bit about their diet and what and
well,
what it's all about.
Their diet is it's the Mediterranean diet of 50 years ago, basically. It's completely reliant on very fresh seasonal food. Most of it is completely local, with a few exceptions, but most people are subsistence farmers. They have their own food. They grow their own food. They have their own animals. They make their own wine. They make their own grape distillates. Very, very independent and very much, they're very in tune to eating with the seasons. So, for example, now it's wintertime. People are out mushrooming. That's a great sport on the island. And it's a very rich place for mushrooms. It's actually not so barren, Ikaria. It's very green. It's heavily forested. Mm. The south side of the island is more barren, but the north side it's all pine forest. So there's a lot of vegetation, and mushrooms are a big part of the diet and very healthy, have a lot of the same nutritional attributes that meat, that red meat has.
Right. Surprising amount of protein.
Yes, a surprising amount of protein. And another, I think, really important part of the diet, and still something that people is they forage for greens. That's also around, greens grow in wild in Greece when it rains. So there are a few greens that grow in the summertime when the country is still, quite dry, but for the most part, the season is from October till May. Mm. And on Ikaria, there are maybe, 150 different types of wild edible greens. Then there's this whole spectrum of wild herbs that people use not only in cooking, but that form a kind of folk medicine, folk pharmacopoeia. And people still use those things. I mean, there are all sorts of remedies that just come from going out and picking something. Right. Oh, you have stomach ache today. Drink oregano. You have a chest cold. Have some sage.
Yeah, I love how you say medicine in a teapot.
Yeah, medicine in a teapot.
Yeah, so they do make interesting teas, a lot of interesting brews, and use the plants. I was reading your description of the mallow and how it's used for so many different things. Interesting. There on the island, of course, it was a very poor island, a couple generations back. And so there wasn't really a lot of food to be had, or at least not available to them, producing-wise. They had to make their own food. So much like a lot of areas in Greece, it was that they weren't overeating. They weren't eating too much. Maybe that helped too.
Yes, that helped a lot. That was something that I encountered when I talked to people who are over 85 and remembered their diets from before the war, but also during the occupation.
The war, I imagine, yeah.
They were really not eating very much. The caloric intake was low, and animal protein was very, very rare. That's changed. It would be interesting to see what the longevity statistics are going to be for our generation.
That's what I was going to ask. Right? Now that we've given them all our bad influences.
Just getting back to the food for a minute, the food is actually quite simple, and it's easy enough for many people to replicate even in an American kitchen. I've done a number, probably more dishes than I've actually admitted to, even on the rest of the menu at Molivos, where I'm the collaborating
chef.
Right,
and I forgot to mention that in the beginning. Thank you for mentioning.
So,
here in New York City, a wonderful
Here in New
Greek
York City, there are,
yeah.
we've got beautiful greens, little greens pies on the menu that are tremendously popular. A salad that is a combination of arugula and sweet potato, that's another, I think, oddity about the diet on Ikaria, the importance of potatoes and sweet potatoes, which have become maligned in the American diet, right?
Because bad carbs, right?
Bad carbs, yeah. But it has to be taken in a certain context.
Yeah, as you say, about your own, nothing too extreme.
Everything, nothing too extreme,
Julia Child's favorite line, too. Everything in moderation.
Everything in moderation.
Yeah, right. You do say that, indeed, there's meat, but not a lot of, and still not a lot of meat. Right?
No, and the main meat is goat's meat, mm-hmm. And pork, which is eaten traditionally in the wintertime. It's usually around this time of the year, most families have animals, so they'll slaughter the family.
A pig, right.
And eat that meat. That will feed me. I mean, again, today is a little bit different because it's still, you know, now modern life has encroached on the island, but that's still a tradition. So there's this huge party around this event, and the meat is shared with an extended family, and it lasts traditionally over, you know, almost the entire year, with the exception of the fasting period. So again, little bits of animal protein.
There and might we're talking be... nose to tail also. Right?
Totally nose to tail. Yeah. Totally.
Interesting. You talk about a lot of things that are specific to the island and to their diet. Goats, you said goat meat, but also goat's milk.
Right? Goat's milk is very important, yeah. Hmm. And that's something that I've seen. We run the classes in the summertime, and most of our guests are Americans. In the last few years, you know, I'm sure you've noticed this too, the garden variety of food-related issues has grown, tremendously.
Active foraging. We're all foraging.
And we've had several people who are lactose intolerant, but when the goat's milk and the goat's milk cheeses doesn't seem to be a problem.
Interesting.
It's a much healthier dairy product.
And how about the phyllo dough for those who are gluten intolerant? Well, I mean, aside from
celiac disease. Yeah, we have a few pies that have cornmeal on top, and I'm pretty accommodating. It's interesting for me, too, to do that, to create recipes that can, you know, I mean, we want everyone, we're Greeks, we like to feed people, so, you know, we want everyone to eat everything, and if I have to make a slight variation, that's okay.
Well, a couple of things that you mentioned that I thought would be interesting and worth describing, you talked about, of course, right off the bat, you know, you talk about breakfast, what is a typical breakfast, and you said goat's milk, of course, and then something that, and I'm going to say it wrong, and you described to me what it is, Crassopsychia.
You really did read the book. That is the unlikely combination of bread dipped in red wine.
It appealed to me.
But again, you have to take that in context. I mean, this is not something that people probably, you know, do. Maybe old timers still do it, but we're talking about a generation or generations of people who really needed the energy to walk and to work in fields and to harvest olives in cold, rainy weather and, you know, to go fishing and to climb up and down mountains. So having, you know, bread and wine is actually quite nutritious.
Yeah. And of course, you got old bread. It's dry.
Right.
Stale.
Exactly.
You got to soften it up, right? You got to dip it in something. Oh, that's great. I love it. And the teas, we talked about a lot of tisanes, a lot of teas, a lot of, you know, herbal concoctions.
The herbal concoctions are great. I mean, when I'm on the island in the summers and in the spring especially, I'm always collecting wild fennel, oregano goes without say, all sorts of mint varieties, including pennyroyal.
I noticed that. Yeah, and sage.
Sage
tea.
Is
interesting.
Yeah.
Totally different. You know,
it's a different
aromatic
species of sage. It's not the Italian, the salvia. Mm. It's a smaller leaf, but it's really aromatic.
Hmm. Interesting. And kumara, the arbutus berries. Yeah, and I was thinking, that sounds familiar. And then I think, of course, that's corbezzolo in Italian. And that's the strawberry. It's the same thing, the strawberry bush, the strawberry tree.
It is. It's called the strawberry bush.
Corbezzolo.
Yeah.
And it makes a very bitter honey.
Yes, it does.
But they also make a liquor.
They distill the berries and make a liquor, yeah. You can find the honey from bees that feed off the blossoms. It's not the Icarian honey is amazing. That particular honey is not, although it's the locals consider it quite therapeutic, it's not the main honey that is produced on the island. Pine is the main honey. Heather, which is thick as peanut butter, and thyme honey are the three main honeys.
Right. Yeah, interesting. And people who aren't accustomed to even rosemary honey, you know, or arbutus honey.
Encountered.
It is very bitter. I mean, it's something more to eat perhaps with a cheese, you know, it's not, it's very bitter, but I was really interested. It's called kumara. And not a lot of sugar in their diet. Right. Or like processed, refined sugar.
Right. Not, there wasn't a lot of sugar.
Now, okay. Now we're talking today. Let's talk about why those people are so old. Yeah, so we're talking generations ago.
Honey was the sweetener. And also something called petimezi.
That's what I wanted to talk about, petimezi.
It's it's basically boiled down grape juice. It's reduced
grape must
before it ferments into wine. And that is one of the world's oldest sweeteners, and it's used a lot. It's delicious. It's really rich in iron. It's really, really good.
Well, you have a recipe for the grape molasses and chocolate cupcakes, which we're going to talk about that after we take a short break. I'm going to talk about a lot of specific recipes in here right after we take a short break.
Okay, thank you.
You are listening to Down to Earth by Eric Maltz.
Today's program was brought to you by Rolling Press. Rolling Press is a family-run digital and offset print house that brings together eco-friendly methods, ethical practices, and personalized service. Using environmentally responsible papers, non-toxic inks, and wind power, Rolling Press represents the harmony of traditional craftsmanship and mindful sustainability. Rolling Press offers advice on reducing paper waste and energy consumption, helping you save money and minimize your carbon footprint. For more information, visit rollingpress.com.
It is so exciting to have this new medium.
Hosting After the Jump has been a huge part of me transitioning from being a blogger to somebody who has sort of real important conversations with people in real life.
My show, I kind of describe it as an audio trade magazine.
I learn a ton from the guests every week, whether it's restaurants, bars.
All the hosts at Heritage all come from different perspectives.
Everyone should be listening to this. If you're interested in conservation and practical approach to renewable food sources, you know, not this big industry.
Whether it's history, laws, social policies of food, I think people now take food seriously, and hopefully what's on their plate will become something very special.
And I feel that podcasting has a future, giving people information in a format they can really use on the go.
We need your support to keep these conversations going. To donate, visit heritageradionetwork.org/donate.
We are students at Girls Prep, and you're listening to Heritage Radio Network.
Hi, I'm back speaking with Diane Kochilas, the author of Ikaria, Lessons on Food, Life, and Longevity from the Greek Island Where People Forget to Die. Interesting, I was saying when we went to break that just looking at the pictures of the food makes me hungry, not only talking about the recipes. And we were talking about specific recipes. You already mentioned the importance of the wild greens and foraging for a lot of these greens, but also the importance, one thing we didn't talk about was the importance of beans and legumes in the diet. So that is a big part of their dishes, beans. And
That's a very big part of the local diet. Even to this day, things like giant beans and lentils, regular white beans, chickpeas, yellow split pea. Some of those are very old pulses, and some of them are New World beans.
Mm-hmm. All right. And of course, fish. I mean, fish has always been a major part of their diet, living with them, you know, on an island, right?
Fish has always been very important in the diet. People fish on the island. The waters around Ikaria are quite deep, so we don't get a lot of fish like sardines, and that comes from other parts of nearby islands. But lots of bigger fish, and the fish is really, when it's fresh, it's amazing.
Mm. And unfortunately, you did mention that there was some pollution that was cutting down on some of the fishing.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a generic issue all over the Aegean.
Indeed, yeah.
It's, you know, the Mediterranean is an enclosed sea, so it is a big issue. And, the fish stocks have been depleted tremendously in the last, I guess, 20 years.
From overfishing and pollution, both.
Yep.
I mean, it's a double whammy there. And as far as grains go, you mentioned that, yes, of course there's wheat, and obviously we know from phyllo dough that, you know, they're going to have wheat. But you said that barley and rye are right up there with wheat consumption.
Barley was traditionally a more sustainable crop on the island because it requires less water.
Mm.
And also, I mean, Icaria is very mountainous, so there are very few places where you can have an open field large enough to grow wheat. That was just the way the island is, you know, the physical makeup of the island. Barley was something that people were able to grow in terraced gardens.
Mm-hmm.
And you see that. You can still see that we have a garden like that. They're just steps basically carved into the side of a mountain. And it was just the most efficient and ergonomic way to grow vegetables. So barley was the traditional grain. Wheat was something that was used for more specialty breads, holiday breads, baking for, you know, holiday baking, that sort of thing. It was a little bit more rare in the diet.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about Trahana soup. You entered a recipe that in the book that is an ancient recipe. And it's Trahana soup. What is Trahana?
Trahana.
Trahana, okay.
is a grain product that was essentially a way to store milk. Hmm. It's a combination of either cracked wheat or bulgur wheat or flour. And either goat's milk. In Icaria, it's goat's milk. Buttermilk, yogurt, or whole milk. There are different recipes for it from place to place around Greece. Sometimes you find vegetarian versions, which are made with vegetable pulp. But for by and large, it's a dairy and wheat product that is cooked. The milk and the grain are cooked together to get a very dense mass, which is then broken up into pieces, I don't know, maybe about 1.5 to 2 inches kind of in diameter. I mean, they're not perfectly round. You just break little pieces off, and you dry those in the sun, usually at the end of the summer when it's very hot, turning them over over a few days. And then you break those up further, and you press them through a sieve. And you get something that looks like little tiny pebbles.
So almost like a little couscous, like a couscous.
It's bigger than couscous. The grains are bigger than couscous. But it's very different. It's very, very hard. It's crunchy.
Mm-hmm.
I like to eat it raw. I mean, uncooked. It's really delicious. It's like eating, imagine the flavor of Greek yogurt in a cracker.
In a crunch.
Yeah. it's really good. Traditionally, it was made into a soup, and it was it's total poor man's food. I mean, it's something that, and it's also the world's first instant, you know, fast food.
Huh.
It takes about 10 minutes to cook. It's very hearty. It's delicious. It's very versatile. We make it. You can put vegetables in there, tomatoes, mushrooms, greens.
So the base of a stew of anything you want to add.
You can use it. It makes a dense, it's usually a 1-6 or 1-8 ratio of Trahana to water or stock. And depending how dense you want it, you can make a soup, or you can make it with chunks of vegetables into like a really, almost like a porridge. Imagine a really thick porridge, mm-hmm, with beautiful Greek vegetables and delicious olive oil.
Wow, wonderful. Which brings to mind another staple of the Greek cuisine, soufiko.
Oh, soufiko.
Tell me about that.
Soufiko is the local vegetable dish. It's there's a summer version and a winter version. The summer version is, actually, we do that at Molivos too. We do a somewhat more Manhattan gentrified version of the soufiko. It's layered potatoes, onions, zucchini, eggplant, simple tomato sauce and oregano, and of course olive oil. And the way it's done traditionally is you gently pan fry each of those vegetables individually, and then you put them all together in a big casserole with even more olive oil and cook them, you know, for maybe another hour or so until they're completely soft and totally married to one another in that pot. Mm. And then you add a little bit more olive oil on top before you serve it, and you have really good bread. It's really
That's all you
delicious.
Need, you know?
Yeah.
Need
it's very
else.
Sweet. Yeah. The vegetables have cooked slowly and have caramelized, and it's total comfort food.
You know, it sounds delicious. It sounds like a hearty meal for a cold winter day too.
It's like ratatouille.
I was going to say ratatouille. Yeah. You said separately. They're all cooked separately and then put together.
Yeah.
So like ratatouille, except that then they're all nicely mushed together with the olive
oil great.
And baked.
There's a winter version that's made with pumpkin. Hmm. And that's also quite delicious.
A lot of pumpkin. I was surprised. There's a lot of squash in the diet. In fact, you have a recipe for longevity pie.
I do. That's right. We have that at Molivos, the longevity
and that's
pie.
So what is in that?
That is grated pumpkin. You can use calabaza squash or butternut squash, a whole variety of greens and herbs, basically whatever you can find in season. So in New York, for example, we would use things like spinach and chard and sorrel and maybe fennel bulb, because wild fennel is almost impossible to find.
Right.
Dill, parsley, mint, chervil, if you can, mm-hmm. you can get that at certain times of the year. On Ikaria, there would be different varieties of mint that also go into that pie. Fresh oregano, fresh marjoram. Really anything, any sweet green and herb. Onions, leeks, scallions or spring onions, a little bit of pumpkin or any of the other red squashes, a little bit of carrot if you don't have squash.
So all encased in a dough or just the dough on top?
No. It's a savory pie.
So it's a pie, the pie all around, right?
Yeah, there's a picture of it on the cover of my book. At Molivos, we do them. On Ikaria, there are two versions. You could do it as a whole pie, or you can do them as individual little pies. They almost look like spring rolls or empanadas. They look more like empanadas than spring rolls.
Yeah.
And we do that version at Molivos, and people love them. They're great. I mean, they just exude healthiness.
So I'm seeing hearing a kind of a trend in the whole food, in the diet, and it's all these greens cooked together and very satisfying, having very humble ingredients, but by the time they're cooked together, very satisfying dishes.
I think that's a very key point, because this food is not the food of abstention. It is delicious. It's enjoyable. It's, you know, user friendly. It's easy.
Well, and you talk about copious amounts of olive oil.
And copious amounts of olive oil.
But it's interesting because you did mention too that the type of olive oil that is most common, or was most common, I don't know what now, but is from not the usual olive that a lot of the olive oil, you know, that we think of is made from, but the Hondelia oil?
It's a bigger olive.
A big olive. Not this. We usually think of the smaller ones that are pressed and have that, you know, very fruity flavor. So what's the flavor of this?
It's a little bit more, I don't know, the main olive variety in Greece is called the Korneiki. It's a very tiny olive, almost like a picholine, maybe a little bit bigger than a picholine. And that's actually very, you get a lot of olive oil from that particular variety. Mm-hmm. The Hondro Elia, which means fat olive, is used both as a table olive and a pressing olive, an oil olive. The flavor is maybe a little bit more rustic. It's extra virgin. A lot of the flavor actually has to do with what happens after you pick the olives, how soon you press them, at what temperature. If they're, you know, you should be cold pressing, obviously. The olive oil is, I mean, it's delicious. It's just a little bit. It's not quite as peppery, say, as the olive oil produced from the smaller better known Greek variety.
Mm-hmm. Interesting, and. Do most everyone have olive trees on their property? I mean, there are a lot of olive groves.
I'm sorry?
Are, a lot of people have olive trees
everyone
on their property.
Has olive trees. Everyone has olive
trees. And one thing I found interesting, you said that even though a lot of people have almond trees, almonds aren't used in savory cooking.
Not very much. There's a very old dish for the green almond before the actual nut forms. Mm-hmm. And they're absolutely delicious. You can stew them. They're soft. They have a beautiful grassy flavor. We have an almond tree in our garden, and I've cooked them when they're unripe. They're really good. And in fact, we had an intern a few years ago who was a young cook at the French Laundry. And she told us that Thomas Keller was also using green almonds in a lettuce salad. So I thought, okay, well.
You're onto something.
There's
then,
nothing
right?
new under the sun, right?
right
but this is really old food.
Right.
Almonds are used mainly in sweets in the cooking.
Yeah, well, that's, well, as they should be. You got to save them for something special, right? And one thing I just love, because I've toyed around with it a little bit, and that's seawater as a condiment. I mean, there you have, well, when you know, we're talking about the clean seawater, you know, and it was so commonly used as a condiment, right?
Yeah, we still do that. If we're
You're
making a fish soup,
good.
We'll go to, find a part of the island that's not where the hotels are, basically.
Yeah. Right. And people, think I'm crazy sometimes when I say, but they say, well,
you just need a little bit. It's salt.
Yeah, you put too much salt in the water when you cook your pasta. I said, no, it should taste like the sea. Take a pot of seawater and cook your pasta and you'll be just fine. So it made perfect sense to me when I read about it. And I loved it. I love the fact that it's there. Use it,
Yeah, that's it. It's there. Use it. That's basically it.
Yeah, now, you say you give these cooking classes, and obviously mostly Americans, or they're not people who live on the island. They're not going to come and take classes from you. You learn from them, right?
I should be taking classes from them. Exactly.
Right. And when do you give the classes?
In the summers. We're doing three sessions in June and July. And one at the end, very end of August, which is a little bit different. It's more wellness oriented. So there'll be, I'm going to do something slightly different, more like a template of food that I hope will empower people to create their own Greek-style healthy, mainly vegetarian dishes.
And they can find out on your website,
DianeCochilis.com.
Okay, we will post that too. And if you take that class, maybe you'll live to be 100. You never know, right?
You're more than welcome.
If it works for those people on the island, then certainly it might work for you. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Making this stop on your whirlwind tour and sharing all this information about this fabulous island and the fabulous food. And the book has wonderful recipes in it. Again, Ikaria, The Island Where People Forget to Die by Diane Cochilis.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. And you've been listening to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palacio.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.